Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. I am very excited today that we have Bruce McCarthy, who is a product manager extraordinaire. He's been doing a tremendous amount of work over the last few years, sort of teaching product managers how to do product management. I ran into him a few years ago at some workshops that happen here in the Boston area called Product Camp, which is this fantastic day-long set of sessions, and he gave a great talk on roadmaps, and I realized there's a lot of intersection between roadmaps and user experience and what we're doing, and so we talked a bit, and today we're going to talk to him about these roadmap and UX things. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Bruce will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 20 Conference, November 2nd through 4th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com.
So, product managers, they are this force in a project. And there are good product managers, and they're, you know, like everything else, they're not so good product managers, just like there are good designers, and they're definitely not good designers. But one of the things that I've learned over the years is that when you have a great product manager on your team, things get done and they get done well. And all of the plates seem to keep spinning.
That's a good way of describing the product manager's job as the chief plate spinner.
Yeah. I don't know if you're old enough. You're probably old enough. A lot of people I talk to are not old enough to remember the Ed Sullivan Show. And there was always that dude who had the plates on sticks where he would just spin them. And he would have like 20 of them. And his entire act was to some Siberian dance music, keeping all the plates spinning. And I never understood what the point of it was. But apparently this is a career path for people.
Apparently. No, but it's a good analogy for product managers. Some people call the product manager like the CEO of the product, and I don't think that's exactly quite right. I think of them more as, to use the business position analogy, a COO, because they are still operating within the strategy set by the executive team, usually, but under that mandate, they are empowered to tap any resources necessary for the success of the product, and their job is to direct all the activities cross-functionally and make sure that they're all pulling in the same direction.
Yeah, and that's how I see it. They tend to run interference for things that want to take the project off track, and they tend to be trying to predict issues that are going to come up while they're still early and easy to deal with. I remember when I was doing software development back in the 80s, I worked with a couple of really awesome product managers. And they were sharp people, but at the time, I did not sense, like most people in the world, I did not sense that they saw design and user experience the same way I did. You know, you've been around this long enough. Has the perspective on how the importance of a good user experience shifted in the product management world?
Oh, dramatically, I think, over time. I've always been a big believer in it myself. Initially, not so much as a business driver, but just because I was interested in the topic. But it's become a necessity for product managers, I think, over time, especially with the shift to SaaS. If you think about it, the product manager is responsible for the success of the product, for the business outcomes of everything that they do. And so the perspective of the product manager has changed with the business necessities. And if you're in a SaaS business, then that business is not just about winning RFPs, as it might be in a big enterprise on-premise software installation, or selling units, as it might be in packaged software, which is all about the promise on the box, if you will, of all the great features that you're going to get. Instead, the real key to winning in SaaS is retention and renewals.
SaaS being software as a service.
Software as a service, right. Where you're paying for the software as a subscription over time. And so that means you can stop paying for that service as a subscription at any time, which means that if I want to be successful as a purveyor of software as a service tools, then I need to be able to make you happy as an ongoing user. I need to have you engaged and using my product every day or at least every month on a regular basis so that come time for the annual renewal, it's a no-brainer for you. Of course, I will sign up again. Or even if it's a B2C product that's more month to month, then every month when the bill comes, you're happy to pay it. You're happy to put in your corporate credit card or set up a PO and just set it and forget it. So that means if I've got to keep you happy and engaged as a user, as a product manager, I'm much more focused on making sure that that's likely to happen, that you can do what you need to do in the product, that you can accomplish your goals, and that you don't dread logging into the product every time. If I go back to when I was a young product manager in the 90s, it was much more about features. It was much more about, do we have the checklist of features that you want compared to the competition so that you will buy at first? But actually, now that I think about it, my perspective about usability being important may have been informed by my first real official product manager job. I worked for a little company called iMarket back in the 90s.
I remember them.
Yeah, you could buy data on CD-ROMs. And it was marketing data, so we sold to marketers. And it was a subscription product. It wasn't delivered over the internet, not initially. Later on, we did that. But it was a quarterly CD that we sent you. And it was an annual subscription. And also, the more you used it, the more data you bought from the platform, the more money we made.
That was a Lotus spinoff, right?
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew those guys. I remember I worked with them when they were at Lotus, and then, yes, they had a great product.
They really did. It lasted quite a long time. It lasted into the new millennium. The company was eventually bought by Dun & Bradstreet.
Yeah, D&B. I remember that.
But we had a subscription product, and we tracked our renewal metrics. We tracked how often people actually used the product once we had a phone home feature built into it, because we knew that the renewal rate was a big lever for the success of our business. And we had a renewal rate around 80%, and we were always working to try to optimize that.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I worked with a lot of teams back in the day, and the not so great product managers, they seemed to focus on, you know, customer surveys, getting customers to rank what features were best, and then just sort of constantly catching up with competitors.
I got to tell you, those are two hot buttons for me. They are really common mistakes, rookie mistakes in my mind, and they bug me when people rely on those things. Because both of them, I think, are really abdicating your responsibility to think strategically about what's going to make your business successful and what's going to make your customer successful, which hopefully is what drives the first one. If all you're doing is getting into a feature checklist war with your competition, well, that's just a recipe for becoming a commodity.
Right.
You know, you and all your competition will have the same list of features, and the only thing left to compete on will be price. And that's a terrible place to be operating. I would much rather be the product or the company that really gets a particular segment of buyers and users, really understands them in depth, and can, as a result, serve them better than anybody else. We did that, I think, pretty effectively at iMarket. There were a bunch of imitators, CD-ROMs where you could buy marketing data, that came out afterward, and they all ended up either going out of business or for a while they sold for $79, you know, once a year instead of our price, which was hovering around $1,000 for a year. And the difference was that we really did understand the marketer. We really did understand their needs. We really got into their heads. We had a usability lab right there in the building with a one-way mirror, and we'd invite people in and watch them use the product and take notes. And as the product guy, I sat through all of those tests and took notes, and we debated about what to test next based on what we'd seen. It was a real driver for us. So the competition thing I always think is a bad idea. If people want to look at my blog, productpowers.com, I have an entry that's been very popular called "Don't Be Better Than the Competition." That's about this particular issue.
Oh, that sounds like a great entry. We'll get a link to that posted out.
The other one you mentioned was voting.
Voting, yes. Oh my gosh, the voting thing.
So there's tools out there that are enabling in the bad sense of the word, like User Voice and Salesforce and others, that allow you to set up a voting system so that your customers can propose ideas and vote on them. I have a blog entry on this too. Dell came out with something called IdeaStorm back when they were having some financial difficulties and having difficulty growing. It was, the whole idea was there would be a forum where customers could send them ideas for products or features, and other customers could vote on them. And very quickly, a bunch of Linux zealots took over the forum, and because they were really passionate about it, went in and, you know, voted every day and managed to put Linux on Dell boxes up to the top of the list.
Right.
But that wasn't going to drive Dell's business. That wasn't innovation. That was just the hobby horse of a small but dedicated group of people.
Yeah, and so many times people ask for things that they're not going to use, or they're asking for a solution that isn't the best solution for them and others.
Well, that's exactly right. Usually I find when a feature request comes in, or a design change request comes in from customers, or from a salesperson, or a customer support person who got it from a customer, it's that person's best guess as to a solution to a problem, but a problem that they haven't articulated. They're not telling you why they want it. And so you collect this list, and product managers usually have hundreds of things on this sort of list somewhere in Excel of feature requests or feature ideas that they try their best to prioritize, but they haven't usually gone and dug underneath the request to understand the real underlying need, to understand the problem that the customer wants solved. What I recommend the product people do, actually, and this is something that UX people can help with, is to figure out the underlying need by going back to the original requester, the customer, the user, and saying, so I got your list of 57 things that you want to change in the product. Can you tell me why you want these things? So let's start with number one. You've asked for this button to move from here to here. Why do you want that? Well, the button is on the opposite side of the screen from the other controls that I use while I'm doing a particular task. Oh, wait, you're doing what task? Well, I've got this thing I need to do every day. Oh, you're the first person who's ever told me that you have to do that thing. I didn't know people did that thing with my product. Tell me more about that. And pretty soon you understand that there's a whole new use case or set of use cases among your customers that you didn't know about, that your product does not serve well. And if that turns out to be common, that a bunch of people are using or could use your product in that way and derive some value, you can come up with a whole new approach to solving that use case that might involve moving that button where the customer asked for it, but more likely involves completely rethinking that workflow. If you do that, if you successfully do that, you might expand your market. You might get a whole bunch of new customers. You might, even if it's not new customers, you might have more engagement and a bunch of much happier users who are more likely to renew. And a bunch of the little onesie-twosie type requests like move this button or change this color will all evaporate from your list of 150 things to do because you solved that one underlying need that you didn't know existed.
And so, you know, people who are off doing user research in the UX space, they're running into this all the time where, you know, one of the mantras of good user research is you don't actually listen to the customer, but you watch what they're doing and you ask lots of questions. And there's a technique that's popular amongst UX people called the five whys, which has its good sides and bad sides. You know, I like the five whys because it sort of basically says, well, don't just stop at the first answer, keep going. What I don't like about the five whys is that it implies that there's only one why to everything. And so if you follow it down, you know, so why do you want this feature? Well, because I need to produce this report. Well, why do you produce this report? Well, because I have to get information to my manager. Well, why does your manager need that information? Well, you know, and you start to drive down this stuff, it implies that at the end of the fifth why, you've got all the information, when in fact, there may be more than one reason for the report. There may be more than one reason that the manager needs the information. Yeah.
I love the five whys construct, and I talk about it frequently when I do talks and when I train product people. But you're right, it's just a tool in the toolkit. Overall, I talk a lot about the need to do qualitative research with your users and your buyers to go and watch what they do and ask why they're doing it, to understand the larger context. You can even do a little bit of that over the phone, although it's not nearly as high fidelity as if you're there in person with them. It all starts with a general understanding of who is this person that maybe represents a persona in my world? What is it that they are trying to accomplish in their job or in their life that's relevant to my product? And where is it that they currently have frustrations? All of the feature request conversations, including the 5 follow-up whys, need to live in the context of that understanding of who is this person and what's important to them and where are they struggling.
Right. Yeah, so we're definitely on the same page with that. And yeah, I mean, I think the 5 whys thing is a great thing just to get people to realize that you can't stop at the first answer. Where I go with it is there's a technique known as a fishbone diagram, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which basically allows for the idea that there's more than one thing at each step and lets you draw them out and fill them out to completion. And then you get to prioritize. It just gives you a bigger picture. But we digress. What I really want to talk about here is the idea that there's a lot of commonality between how a product manager is trying to figure out what's the right priority and direction for this thing that, I guess, one of my senses is that one of the differences that separates a really awesome product manager from a not so awesome product manager is that a really awesome product manager is always thinking sort of in multiple releases. And in fact, this is one of the things I remember about working with iMarket back in the day. When they were at Lotus, and I think after that, they would have on the wall what was in this release, what was in the next release, what was in the next release. And if I remember correctly, you guys shipped like 4 times a year. 2 of the releases were bug fixes, 2 of the releases were new feature elements, and that all those things were planned out. And if somebody wanted to add something to the upcoming release, oh, we need to put this in the app, you had to ask the question, okay, what's not going to be there?
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of physics.
Right. But the people who are not very good product managers, I think they just say, yes, sir, we'll do that. We'll get it in there somehow. And everything seems to be focused on the next release and this notion. But this idea that there's a long lifetime to a product is something that I think is just becoming understood to many people who work outside of product management.
I think that's true. And I think, again, it may have something to do with the increasing prevalence of subscription models. We appreciate that there is a kind of a, at least nominal, or an opportunity for a purchase decision more frequently, not just once, but over the lifetime of a relationship with a customer. They're going to be making the decision to keep going or not keep going with you many, many times. And so you've got to continue to satisfy. In fact, because the competition is catching up and because there are always new alternatives, you've got to find ways over time to continue to raise the bar on satisfaction with your existing customers. And so, you know, going back to what you were saying about thinking about releases over time, I think, you know, really good product managers have always thought that way. They've always realized we're going to have to increase our value over time. We're going to continue to work on this thing and make it better and more compelling. Even if we do have a one-time sale, we've got to be able to get to a broader and broader market over time. But I remember early in my product manager days when we all operated more or less on waterfall and release schedules could be very long, they could be years. The prevalent question about any given feature was, does it have to be in the release? And the release, capital T, was your sole focus, the next release. And that's a difficult world to live in as a product person, because what you want to be making is decisions about increasing value to the customer and thereby to the company over time. And exactly on what intervals you release that value is somewhat important, but not the most important thing. The most important thing is that you do the most highly leveraged things first. the things that are the biggest bang for the buck, the things that add the most value for the least investment in time and resources, and that you sort of set up an ongoing train of adding those things. And that release schedule that you described that we had back at iMarket, I remember it vividly. We had it up on the wall, and I was responsible for it for a good while, was a roadmap. That it's the sort of prototypical definition of a roadmap is we're looking 4 to 6 releases out, and we're saying at a high level, these are the things that we're trying to tackle in each of those releases. You hit it at the very highest level, feature release followed by bug fix, followed by feature release, followed by bug fix, very high level. But we also would bring it down one level from there. And instead of talking in depth about a bulleted list of, you know, 57 features or a bunch of tickets in Jira that we were going to try to get to, we would talk about it in broad themes. We would talk about it in terms of problems we were trying to solve for customers.
Now, I've heard you talk about these themes before. Remind me again. A theme is different than features.
Yeah. So a feature is like we're going to shorten up the number of steps in the checkout process on an e-commerce website. You know, you go to Amazon and you've got 5 or 6 steps in the checkout process when you're buying something. You got to put in your credit card. You got to give it the shipping address. You got to verify this, that, and the other thing. And eventually you get to checkout. And a feature would be like reducing the number of steps by, say, combining the shipping and financial credit card address on the same screen instead of as 2 steps. But then you have to ask yourself, if somebody has suggested this idea, whether it's design or engineering or product or a customer, why are we doing that?
Yeah, why are we doing that?
Right. What problem are we trying to solve? It turns out that we have drop-off during the checkout process. At each stage, there's a percentage decrease in the number of people who make it to the next stage. And so we kind of figure that if we combine some stages, we'll lose fewer people along the way. Oh, well, so now we're trying to solve a problem. We're trying to solve a problem of abandoned carts. And so we might actually decide that there are potentially many things we could do that would help us resolve this problem with abandoned carts. Maybe there are too many steps. We could test that as a way to reduce the fall off. Maybe there's a problem with one particular step where, you know, people can't remember their credit card number or something. Or maybe some part of one of the screens is just incomprehensible to the user. They don't know what's being asked for and they keep putting in the wrong information and we keep throwing errors. Or maybe it's that people are just easily distracted and they lose interest halfway through and they mean to come back, but they never do. And so maybe we need to send them email reminders. Hey, you know, did you still want those ski boots? Because they're sitting in the cart ready for you to check out. There's, you know, probably a dozen different ideas about how we could improve the experience of the checkout in order to lose fewer people along the way. And if I'm putting something on a roadmap that says that we're going to address that problem 6 months from now, I've got 6 months to figure out what the best solution is. And it might not be reducing the number of steps. So instead of saying 6 months from now on the roadmap, we're going to reduce the number of steps in the checkout process, I'm going to describe a theme, a benefit-oriented problem-solving theme. And the problem I'm trying to solve is to increase the checkout rate or decrease the cart abandonment rate. That's a benefit to me, the company, not to the user, but hopefully the user actually wanted the ski boots, so it's a benefit to them indirectly too. So that's what I'm going to put on the roadmap, is I'm going to say we're going to reduce cart abandonment, and I've got, you know, 12 ideas that we're going to explore along the way and test our way to what 1 or 2 or 3 of those are the best ideas.
So these themes really allow you to hone in on the problem, not the solution.
Right.
And it seems to me that that is where, if you have on your team people who know how to do user research, people who have good design skills, that's where they would thrive.
Absolutely. And this is where I work very closely with UX people. I actually use UX people to help me fill out my roadmap. I've got an existing product or a prototype for a product. I'm starting somewhere and I'm thinking about the next 12 months to 18 months worth of things that I want to put on the roadmap. And I have some ideas about that, but it's difficult for me to be certain of the priority of those things. And it's also difficult for me to be sure about which solution is actually the right solution to a particular problem. So I'll put out problem-solving type of themes, like the ones we talked about, in a preliminary way, based on the feedback that we're getting from the prototype or from the current version of the product, the problems that are coming up from user research or even from requests after I've asked my five levels of why. And I'll put that out there, and then I want to work with a UX person to validate that these problems are in the right priority order. They're all real problems, and the worst problems are being addressed first. And for any given problem, you know, we'll work through prototypes, clickable mock-ups or whatever, of potential solutions to that problem. And we'll try them out on users and see what really works the best. And if we're working ahead like that, then my roadmap gets smarter and smarter and better and more likely to actually solve the right problems in the right order as we go.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, you know, that's where you get to do some of the stuff that we're talking about these days around testing assumptions and putting out hypotheses and creating sort of this notion of what people call a minimal viable product, but is really just what's the least we have to do in order to see if, in fact, we understand the problem.
Right. I'm a big believer in this minimum viable product, this MVP concept, but many people misunderstand it. It's sort of...
Yeah, they think of it as what's the least we can get away with shipping.
Right, right. The crappiest version one that we can possibly put out. But in fact, it is what is the smallest amount of work, you said it well, that we can do in order to validate a hypothesis, to verify that our assumptions about our business plan, we're going to provide a product, a certain product with a certain feature set to a certain market, and they're going to be willing to pay for it, and we're going to be able to acquire them in a profitable way. You got to figure out whether those assumptions are all right before you actually go and build the entire product and start to market and then find out that some of those assumptions were wrong.
Right.
And UX people are, I have found, highly, highly leveraged in those early days of testing your assumptions. I've done this over and over again, actually. We did it at NetProspects, and we are doing it right now with the startup that I've founded called Rex, REQQS.com. It's a product for product managers that helps them with prioritizing and road mapping. And what we did early on with that product was to first do a bunch of research with product managers to understand their problems, and when they asked for features, to ask them why they wanted them. Get those problems boiled down to the essential few, which with product managers, it turned out the worst problems are prioritizing and road mapping, both the decision-making part and the communications and getting everybody bought in parts of that process. But then the whole question was, well, do we have a solution to those problems? Do we have something that will actually provide value in those problems over and above the alternatives, which right now for most product managers are Excel and PowerPoint? And so we did mock-up after mock-up, and I walked users through those mock-ups, and we set them up in a clickable fashion so you could go from one page to the next as though it were a real product with real data, and kept optimizing it based on the feedback that we were getting until the point where we had something that was in HTML and clickable and apparently responsive, even though there was no database behind it, that people said, yeah, this is great. If I could put my real data in it, this is exactly what I would want. And then we went from there into producing the real code and reused a whole bunch of the front-end code, not all of it, but a lot of it. Similarly, at NetProspects, I was building a tool for salespeople that was basically a search tool for contact information, and it was for telephone salespeople, for what they call BDRs, who just make lots and lots of outbound phone calls all day long and make appointments for salespeople. And so this was a quick lookup tool, essentially, for getting the right contact information for somebody you wanted to reach. We had a whole team of these BDRs. We had 25 of them at NetProspects in-house. So I said, perfect. I will produce a clickable mock-up, and I will put it in front of them and see what they think. I learned a huge amount by doing that. And then after we got beyond the clickable mock-up stage and into early prototypes, but the UI was still, you know, very minimal, I would put it in front of them and have them actually use it in their job and see where it did or didn't work for them. I quickly learned to keep the UI simple, and it actually helped me reduce the feature count that we needed in order to get into our first release, because I discovered that some of the advanced features that I thought people would think were really cool, that the salespeople couldn't figure out how to use them. So we just cut them, and we had a better product for it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like these are such obvious things, yet many teams feel like they have to discover it on their own and reinvent what's already known.
Well, I have some hope that the world is getting a little bit more educated about the necessity to involve design early and often, and about the value of crafting an entire user experience and buyer experience all the way from, I think about it as a journey that starts all the way from the marketing and publicity stuff where people do, you know, speaking at events, or they write blogs, or they have advertising to try to create some awareness, all the way through the buying process, all the way through the first use process, all the way through the repeat use process and the renewal, and eventually, hopefully, referral to other potential customers. That whole process and the experience of your buyer and your user through that entire process has to be optimized if you want to have a profitable business today.
Yeah, I think that entire sort of thinking of the experience is definitely the way that organizations are going, and that everybody needs to be ready for this. Well, I'm really excited about your workshop at UI20. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be a great way for folks from the design community to understand how to influence the roadmap and influence the strategy of the product, and to sort of bring their superpowers as UX people into the process and be able to build better experiences and be contributing to the team in even a bigger way than they already are.
I'm excited about it too. You know, I think there's a lot of overlap there between those roles. I think only good can come from closer collaboration between the two of them. And I know people who have jumped the fence between those two roles and found sort of a renewal of enthusiasm for coming to work and new challenges. I would encourage anybody on the UX side to think about whether product management is for them. It's a crazy job, can be stressful, but it's hugely rewarding. You really get to see the fruit of your labors when a product ships.
Yeah, I have many friends who started out as designers and user researchers and other folks in the UX side and have found their ways into product management and working on the product team. And we go to lunch and they're just as nice as they've always been. Nothing about them seems to be that different.
So you're saying it's not going over to the dark side?
No, that's complete myth. Whoever is spreading that rumor is complete myth. Bruce, thanks today for taking the time here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And to all of you listening, if you want to see Bruce in action and to hear how your work can influence product strategy and how the product management world can make your life a lot easier, you want to attend his workshop at UI20, which will be November 2nd through 4th in Boston, Massachusetts. It's a full-day workshop where you'll talk about all of the things we've talked about today and more. And so you want to check that out. Thanks to Bruce. Thanks to everybody who's listening. And thank you very much for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
For more information about Bruce's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's UICONF.com. As always, thanks for listening.